Les colloques du Collège de France.
Thank you very much. Thank you, Muriel, for that wonderful presentation. And thank you, Nathalie, for having us all here at this very privileged venue. So my name is Michelle Kelly Irving. I'm a social epidemiologist. I'm going to do my talk in English, even though I'm a Gen DPI. I'm part of the Anglosphere, so I will be doing it in English. And thank you to the interpreters who are doing an amazing job. And I'll try and keep it slow for you. So today I'm going to talk about how in the Gendy project, and well beyond that in other work we're doing, we're interested in trying to capture how socio-structural processes that underlie the production of health inequalities, and that this is operating through the embodiment dynamic, which I'm going to go through with you. So to make sure we're all on the same page, when I'm talking about health inequalities, I'm talking about systematic, avoidable, and unfair differences in health that can be observed between populations, but also between social groups within the same population, and that forms often a social gradient. So when we're thinking about these health inequalities, I thought I'd start with some good news, because guess what? There is some good news despite the somewhat depressing times we're in. Well, these health inequalities here, if we take under 5 mortality rate as a measure of health across the world, and we look at different parts of the world in terms of income, well, we can say that since I started working, and I'm not, by the way, putting this down to my work, but since the beginning of my career, we have seen dropping down those inequalities across the world when we compare across nations and across regions of the world. And this is a graph from the recent WHO Health Inequalities Report, which I recommend. We'd like to see those inequalities drop further, and I think we are probably all agreed here that that will depend on the political will, not just on our own work. Okay, so now to the bad news. Between country inequalities have been coming down, but within country inequalities is where the real problem is. These graphs are from French data on life expectancy beyond the age of 35 in France over time here on the x-axis, according to educational groups, with women on the left, men on the right. So the gray line at the bottom represents the people who have the lowest level of education and who we can see have the lowest life expectancy over time. The darker line is the most educated people. So we can really see that marked gradient. And we can also see that it hasn't really moved. Certainly in the first section of the graph, it's really quite, the gap just stays marked. And unfortunately, what we're observing on the right-hand side is that inequalities are really starting to widen, and it's being driven by the life expectancy drops in the most disadvantaged people. We can see much wider inequalities in men than in women, and if anything, what we see is that women from the most disadvantaged educational group, their life expectancy resembles almost to a T that of the most advantaged men in France. So the gap between men and women is massive. And could it be that we could argue that patriarchy and the systems of power that I'm going to get into now are pretty bad for men's health as well? So let's think about now those different pathologies that Cyril was talking about. Actually, there are many, many pathologies that are socially marked and socially patterned. It's hard to find ones that aren't. Here we're looking at cancer mortality rates across Europe in terms of the educational gradient. So consistently what we see in men and women is that those black dots are higher up, which indicates to us that those people with the lowest level of education are most at risk of mortality from cancer across European countries in men and women. But what we can see then when we look at the relation between the little dots is that that varies quite a lot, actually, between countries. So again, the work to understand what's happening within countries is still there, and we still have a lot to do. And you can see France highlighted there. The reason I highlight France is to say there are really marked inequalities in France, despite what many people think, and despite having a universal healthcare system. So now let's dive in under the skin a little bit more. But some of the work that we do in the equity team and that we're interested in also in the GenD project is looking at what biomarkers, what the milieu intérieur, the inside milieu, I'm referring to Claude Bernard because, you know, of where we are. Well, what's going on inside the body? Well, what we can see from this work that we did a number of years ago now across six different cohort studies in European countries is that we had three different life course stages of social position: father's occupation, educational attainment, and participants' most recent occupation. And what we can see is that the grey lines of the most disadvantaged groups at each time and at each moment had higher levels of global inflammation, where we used CRP, so C-reactive protein, which is a marker, in this case, of global inflammation. Now, we did this study on other inflammatory markers, and we've also done it across different biological layers of inflammation. So there is strong evidence that the social environment seems to be eliciting the physiological response of inflammation. Now, what does that mean? Well, let's have a look at when that might start in life. Actually, some evidence from our colleagues in Porto in a child cohort study reveals to us that in both girls on the left and boys on the right, in terms here of household income, we can see that this inflammatory process of having higher level of CRP may start from the age of four already. We can see that the girls there, the ones from the most advantaged group, have a lower level of inflammation. We see similar things with boys. It's a little bit less clear. But then over the 3 years of the life course that they were able to look at longitudinally, the authors showed that that social pattern really fans out in terms of inflammation. Now, the big question is, what does that mean? Is that actually important for health or not? Is it merely a signal that our bodies are responding to our social environment? Or is there going to be health consequences for those trajectories? These are questions we still need to answer. But what they bring us to is an understanding that, that this social environment that we swim in every day is affecting our physiology. And therefore, I would like to acknowledge the definition of embodiment, this embodiment defined by Nancy Krieger, where she says at the most general level, embodiment refers to how we, like any living organism, literally incorporate biologically the world in which we live, including our societal and ecological circumstances. And I would suggest that this concept of embodiment, of how we bring our outside into our inside, is fundamental as a set of processes underlying the production of health inequalities over the life course. And we have to consider it as a life course set of processes. It's often overlooked by scientists and from the medical world, often during the COVID pandemic, where these things were being observed, the incidence, the mortality rate of disadvantaged populations being much higher. The go-to explanation was often genetic and not any other aspect of biology, which is strange because of embodiment, it's an adaptation process. So it's often misunderstood, but I think it helps to explain these persistent inequities, and we need to consider it as an adaptive set of processes. So for us to tap into now what I'm going to talk to about as the ubiquitous intersectional systems that affect our this production of health inequalities through embodiment is I'm going to, of course, refer to the concept of intersectionality. I'm referring back to Crenshaw and the historical work in black feminism, when I'm talking about intersectionality. But here I've taken the definition that Lisa Bowleg offered in 2012 because it really relates to the production of health inequalities. So how social positions such as gender, social class, race, ethnicity, sexual orientation, etc., intersect at the micro level of individual experience to reflect interlocking systems of privilege at the macro social structural level. So as you can imagine, we're talking about, and this is my kind of constantly in work heuristic model that I never stop thinking about, is we're thinking about these ubiquitous intersectional systems at the very most macro level, and how we're swimming in these through our life courses, across early life social position, education, adult social position, through the pathways that we've already heard of, that Cyril and Owen mentioned, material pathways, the kind of housing you live in, if you're breathing in pollution because of where you work, the psychosocial pathways, such as the relationships you have with your family members or your work colleagues, the behavioral aspects that we evoked already, and healthcare, and that this then affects what's going on in under the body, inside the body, and how we're trying to pick up what's happening in there. And for that, from that point of view, in the embodiment work, we try and use indicators such as things like epigenetic methylation, inflammation, lung function, which of course partially only capture that immense internal complexity, which is interacting with that immense external complexity. And then we've got this constant dynamic over the life course where all of this is interlocking and talking to each other constantly. So in the GENDI project, we've been interested in these health inequalities as produced at the intersection of structural social systems. And I'm going to focus, as you would expect, based on what I've just been saying about embodiment, on how bodies are constructed over the life course. And I hope you will be interested in hearing two examples from the GENDI project. And of course, there's lots of work going on. So I'm zooming in on two pieces of work to exemplify what I'm trying to say about those ubiquitous structural systems and how they affect our bodies. I'm going to talk about Inès Malroux's work embodied childhoods, and also Léna Silberzon's work on intersectional examination of blood pressure. And I'm going to consider and discuss the findings that they have and we have been working on together, but through a life course framework. I'm going to interweave the concept of intersectionality across the five different principles of the life course as they were proposed by Glenn Elder in the life course framework. So I'll get to that in sort of the discussion section to illustrate how we can also use different lenses to interpret our findings. So now to start with the work that we're doing with Inès and my colleague Lydia Panico. We were interested in understanding what's happening in childhood, but without necessarily having biomarkers to look at these things. So we were interested in describing child development indicators at the intersection of gender and social class using the French birth cohort study called ELF, which was set up in 2011. We have a child development inventory that was collected at the age of 3.5 years of age, which is broken down by a number of different skill sets for that the children are measured, that are measured about what the children are up to, and I'm going to focus on two of them. The first skill set is called expressed language. So where the children, and there is a questionnaire asking about how the children are creating their sentences, sentence structure, vocabulary, and so on. And the second one is called self-help or bodily autonomy. And that skill set is all about whether the child's able to do things in relation to their own body. So can they wash and dry their hands? Can they eat by themselves? Can they go to the toilet? Can they do up a button by themselves? So the descriptive findings from this work, first of all, in yellow on the left, We're looking at just the two indicators descriptively in terms of the sex category, so girl versus boys, and we see what we would expect to see from the literature. In other words, that for the most part, girls have and perform better on average in these skills than boys do. And we see that for both expressed language and the self-help bodily autonomy skill set. If we look over on the blue graph, what we see over there on that chart is social class. And there we see again what we would expect for expressed language. So children from the most advantaged households performing better on this expressed language set of skills. And there's a very clear gradient there where the children, what is that stepwise relationship between the language and social class. But what we observe on the self-help side over there, so bodily autonomy, is something that hinted towards an inverse gradient, which was quite an interesting finding, and not necessarily what we were finding in the literature. So there what we're observing is that on these bodily autonomy skills, that the children from the most disadvantaged families seemed to be performing better than the children from the most advantaged families. So intrigued as we were, we moved along and performed some modeling, some regression modeling with an interaction term for the sex and social class categories. And so I'll summarize briefly what this shows. So for expressed language, well, this work really confirmed then was that social gradient in expressed language. So children from the most advantaged families having the better results in expressed language, and that kind of stepwise change along social class observed in boys and in girls, and the social gradient really being quite consistent for boys and girls across social classes. But what we were observing then with bodily autonomy and self-help was something quite different. So let's have a look here at what we saw. So this was revealing to us that girls do well on self-help and bodily autonomy really consistently across social class groups with no gradient. So girls are good at these skills, but that doesn't matter. It's regardless of their social class. Whereas boys, it seem to do less well in these social in these skills of bodily autonomy if they're from the most advantaged social groups. And in fact, the boys who perform the best on these skills and resemble the girls the best are from the most disadvantaged group. So by looking at the intersection of these ubiquitous systems of gender and class, using these child development indicators, which are normative markers that tend to be used in the educational setting, in the medical setting, in the psychologist's office. So they're widely used, and they need to be critiqued, obviously, but we can think about when they're being used, what are they actually showing? We can start to see that for the bodily autonomy skills, do these findings challenge accepted stereotypes, which suggest that sometimes girls are essentially better at these skills, that they're biologically more developed? Well, if that was the case, would we observe the gradient in boys? So I think it challenges some of those norms and some of those thoughts about bodily autonomy and what's going on as a form of embodiment. But I will discuss it further through the life course lens later. So now we're jumping to a different stage of the life course altogether. And in fact, quite a long stage of the life course, because it's pretty much most of adulthood, through Lena's work, which we're carrying out with Lena and Nathalie Bajos. This work looks at the Constance cohort study, and the aim was to map predicted systolic blood pressure across intersectional groups to identify those who might be potentially at higher risk of developing hypertension and the health consequences of hypertension. So it was applying an explicit intersectional theory to study blood pressure across the Constance cohort study, which was a general population study in France set up in 2012. Here there are 150,700 individuals in this specific piece of work, aged 25 to 69. So most of adults, most adulthood range. Obviously there's not the very old and the very young adults. And the work is nested, the groups are nested within 126 intersectional strata, which are defined by multiplying, combining sex, age, race, ethnicity, and education together. So from a descriptive point of view, first of all, it's worth pointing out the hypertension, which is measured as the classic cutoff of 140 over 90 millimeters of mercury, or being treated for hypertension. We see that in the orange bars, first of all, that consistently across race ethnicity groups, which you find on the x-axis, men are more at risk of hypertension than women. It's what you would expect to see. But what we see by looking at these race ethnicity groups for France, which were collected based on nationality and migration status, is that the sub-Saharan African group and the overseas France group, so from the overseas French territories, they have higher overall rates of hypertension, and the gap between men and women is actually smaller. So there's something again going on at the intersection of the sex category and what we have available as a race ethnicity variable. So Lena performed some further work here on systolic blood pressure distribution. Now this work is particularly interesting because we're able to isolate the people at the highest end of the distribution of systolic blood pressure up at the top, and then you see the people at the lowest level of the distribution of systolic blood pressure. And so what we see is a very clear pattern up on the highest end, where age and sex is really driving what's going on up on that risk group of systolic blood pressure. So it's the older men who are, you know, really featuring strongly in that area of the distribution. But what we also see is that in the highest levels of systolic blood pressure, it's the sub-Saharan African and overseas territory French men, regardless of their education, who are featuring up there. So they're at the higher end of that risk distribution. If we look at the bottom of the distribution, again, very, very marked by age and sex, it's the younger women who are featured in the lower level of systolic blood pressure distribution. We see quite a rather diverse set of groups in terms of the race ethnicity categories, but we see in the really bottom four groups that it's the higher educated group. So HS means high school. So they're the people with a higher level of education down there. So, you know, how do race, ethnicity, and education contribute is really maybe perhaps slightly different at the upper and lower ends of the distribution. If we think here now, looking at the same findings stratified for men and women across age groups, there's something, another important aspect to highlight, which is that the higher level of systolic blood pressure note that we've noted in the sub-Saharan African and overseas territory groups is in fact present in the youngest age groups. So from a young age, these people have a higher level of systolic blood pressure on average, which really presents a risk and perhaps prevention opportunities for health for the future. And we see that in women and in men. And we also see quite a steep incline in the second two age groups for men. So this work's important because in France, we lack evidence on how racialization and perhaps racism is affecting people's health as it is embodied in physiologically, which we can see here through this blood pressure work. So now I'm going to take those two examples and discuss them through the five principles of ELDER. And don't worry, the couple of principles are grouped together, so I'm hoping to not be too long-winded about it. So here we're going to start with the first of ELDER's principles, which is where I think intersectionality really fits in quite well, and it's quite important to integrate in his historical time and place. And each time I did a little quote, that's the ELDER's explanation of what that principle is about. So here we're talking about how individual life courses are embedded and shaped by the historical times and places they experience. And when we think about intersectionality, I think this is a really interesting place to place that reflection. So when we think about Inés's work on embodied intersectional childhoods, this principle makes us think about what are the lived experiences of children up to the age of 3.5 in France today at the intersection of gender and social class, and also we could add into that race, ethnicity. What is it to be a boy of from a working class family today in France? What experiences do those people have, those children had until now? What is it like going to school with those intersecting categories? Again, we can look at this in terms of the blood pressure distribution. Who were the people who we identified in these top and bottom levels of these intersecting strata, and also all along? What lives have they lived in France, or maybe before coming to France? What are the impacts of social policies and political determinants on, for example, their access to healthcare? Who these people are is important from that point of view. And of course, all this work on blood pressure reminds us of how structural racism and discrimination affect people's bodies, such as the work on weathering, for example, and I refer to Geronimus's work on that. Now, if we take lifespan and timing of events, and I put them together because I just feel like they go together, human development and aging as being dynamic, continuous, and lifelong processes needs to be considered simultaneously with the fact that antecedents and consequences of life transitions and events are variable according to the moment at which they occur. And in biology, you often hear about programming, how there are moments of programming across the life course, but we can think about how there are important sensitive periods that are socially constructed and socially lived. So it's not just about taking things from the biological aspect, but really thinking about how those are socially built. So again, from the embodied intersectional childhood work, to what extent do the developmental markers used here, that are again those normative markers, how do they reflect embodied realities? Are they showing something real, or are they showing something else? And what are the consequences if these are real and observed realities? What are the consequences for the child's present life and for their life moving forward from their educational careers, for example? In Inés's work, she thinks about how perhaps some of these skill sets are valued by the educational system and other ones perhaps are less so. And one questions, therefore, whether the autonomy and bodily autonomy skills that we see performed better in the more disadvantaged boys, are they valued by the education system? Here's a question. From the socially patterned blood pressure distribution, well, we know, and this is work, when I started out as a baby researcher, I was working on the developmental origins of adult disease, where we know that blood pressure can track from in utero. So it can be constructed and built in the intrauterine environment, often due to placental insufficiencies, which are, again, you know, what's going on in women's lives that may lead them to have difficulties and problems in their health at that moment. And those things can track forward, and there may be then sensitive periods that can be considered in terms of the physiological responses to the social environment. So at what age and life stage does hypertension emerge across these intersecting categories? Well, we saw that it may emerge early. We would need to do longitudinal studies further to confirm that, but it may be emerging early in racialized people in France. And the final two principles are linked lives, about the way our lives are lived as interdependent and socio-historical influences are expressed through a network of shared relationships, and human agency and opportunity, which has been mentioned a few times today, so people not being passive actors, but actually having agency, how individuals construct their own lives through the choices and actions they take regarding opportunities. From the embodied childhood's point of view, we can ask, across these intersections of social class and gender, who do the children spend their lives with? And of course, when we're talking about childhood, we really want to know who is living with children, who are their families, who are their siblings, how many siblings are there? Do they live in a multi-generational household? Do they have caring responsibilities at the age of 3.5? Perhaps those bodily autonomy actions that they're performing on themselves, they're also performing on their siblings or someone else in the household. So I think we can think about these also as an indication of agency. Is this a sign of them wanting to do these things or not? Especially with the boys, I wonder, and I've had a discussion with another researcher, does this bodily autonomy among the more disadvantaged boys come at a cost of some sort? And if so, what would it be? From the socially patterned blood pressure distribution, we can consider intersectionality about what are people's life roles at different moments and different ages, which we're measuring hypertension or blood pressure. What are their working and household roles? What's their family structure? To what extent can people pay attention to their own bodies? So those are just some reflections. I don't have any answers. I wanted to acknowledge also all the other, and this is just from the quantitative side, all the other quantitative pieces of work going on in GENDI that reflect our thinking and our moving forward in what we mean by embodied health. So the body image work by Ophélie Merville, the intersectional perspectives on parental well-being by Faye Santos, the symptomatology work by Richard Dudouet and Eugénie Alcadet, the early life disadvantage and biological health work being done at the moment by Lena Bounin, and in terms of colorectal cancer, incidence and tumor characteristics are being examined as forms of embodiment by Nadine Hemier and Amalia Martinez. So I have a few minutes, and I'm going to address the big question of causality that we were discussing earlier. So when we're thinking about these ubiquitous intersectional systems, this is what I have in mind when I then come to the question of causality. So we'll see how I get on with trying to reconcile these things. So there are people, and I think some of this has been addressed by Owen's work earlier, that have expressed that there, I'll quote Mackenbach here, there is surprisingly little robust evidence that the correlation between socioeconomic inequalities and health inequalities is causal. Well, this was something that really made me ponder. That's me wondering. And I was wondering, why are social determinants so easily dismissed as not being true causes of health inequalities when there seems to be so much evidence that they are? And Cyril and I and others wrote a paper to respond to Mackenbach's work in 2022 to evoke how we feel like the evidence body, the canon of evidence that does exist on health inequalities is really vast. It crosses many, many disciplines, social epidemiology, sociology, anthropology, economics, and so on. But yet, what's considered to be true evidence is a tiny proportion of that. And we're advocating for looking at the evidence much more broadly and triangulation. And when I think, when we get to the ubiquitous intersectional systems, I actually think we need to almost go beyond this point. Because like a landscape immersed in thick fog, the social environment is omnipresent and it touches everything. And if we're thinking about the life course, we think about how it affects the way you're raised as a child, where you live, you go to school. It affects the type of food you eat, the people you form relationships with, the type of job you have. It affects your retirement. It affects when and how you die. So I would put forwards that these intersectional, ubiquitous systems affect health indirectly and directly through a tissue of causal structures, having small but potentially really widespread effects on population-level health, disease, and mortality. And I'm not alone in thinking this or working on this idea. Back in 2016, Keyes and Galea wrote a chapter on this in their book, where they say that small changes in ubiquitous causes may result in a more substantial change in the health of populations than larger changes in rarer causes. Right, so what do we do about this problem? Well, I know in the room we have at least one philosopher who might be able to help us about thinking about causality. I'm going to attempt to put to you what I think the problem is. And I think the problem is how we define causality in quantitative science is insufficient to deal with the problem when we're thinking about ubiquitous intersecting systems. So usually we think of causality as events, as causes. And the classic definition, which is the classic definition of quantitative causality. Except that when we're dealing with a massive set of systems that are literally the water we swim in every day, we're not talking about events. We're talking about substantial entities as causes. So I would suggest that in most statistical causal evidence methods, we're looking at how one event, I give you a medication, changes another event, your blood pressure goes down, maybe or maybe not, but two events. Or we're talking about counterfactual approaches and observational data. Let me simulate if everyone smoked in society, what would that change in their health outcomes? Except that substantial entities and ubiquitous causes are not causal events. The very existence of them is a cause in and of itself because it causes the unequal distributions observed. And so I don't think this position of causality is really considered as a real one in quantitative causal statistical modeling. I don't have an answer as to how we need to change, but I think we need a shift in our definitions of causality if we're going to start to address structural determinants of health. So I'm going to wrap up and we can see what Anne thinks about all this. So just some concluding remarks. Embodiment, as you'll have guessed, I feel is one of the most fundamental processes that underlies the production of health inequalities over the life course. And the intersectional ubiquitous systems that I discussed and we've been discussing all morning affect who in society experiences adversity, discrimination, and their lifelong embodied consequences. And to address such structural determinants in quantitative research, I think probably requires us a shift in our definition of causality. But again, that's work in progress, I think. So I just wanted to say thank you again, thank you to the whole Gendy team, and thank you for listening.
Collège de France, le savoir en illimité. Retrouvez tous nos contenus audio et vidéo sur notre site collège-de-france.fr, les plateformes de podcast et nos chaînes YouTube.